I learn much more from the inmates than I teach them. Okay? They write me letters, thank you so much, thank you, thank you, thank you. It's so helpful. I appreciate what you do so much. I don't do anything. These people teach me so much. It's absolutely amazing. If you go to my website, if you take one of the Abbey brochures in the back, there's two websites on it. One is shravastiabbey.org, the other one is tuptonchudren.org. If you go on tuptonchudren.org and click on the prison section, I have a whole bunch of things in there that are either the prisoners' writings, either excerpts from letters that they've given, that they've let me put online, or things that they've written. Okay? Read those. It's incredible the wisdom that these people have. What they learn, how they learn things. It really blows me away. It's hard to express it. Yeah? Yeah. Yes. Okay, so prisoners' ability to forgive themselves. Very good point. Thank you for bringing that up. This goes into the whole self-esteem issue. Okay. Now, mind you, I'm talking just about the prisoners who contact me. So this is not necessarily representative of all the prison population. But the ones who contact me are often, they're looking for some spiritual answers. They're looking for a new way to understand life. And as we correspond, as we write, they're looking for a way to forgive themselves. Okay? When I write, I ask them very tough questions. I don't sit and write about the weather and what I'm doing and, you know, what did you eat for lunch. I write, you know, tell me about your family background. You know, tell me about your struggle with depression. Tell me about your alcoholism. Or what was your mind looking for when you did the crime? Yeah, what was going on in your life? What was your mind looking for at that time? I ask them very tough questions, and they respond to me sometimes saying, that was a really hard question, let me think about it. Okay? But very often what comes out of that level of honesty is people writing to say, I need to find a way to forgive myself. Or actually, sometimes they're not even at that point. They don't necessarily think it's possible to forgive themselves. They write and say, I feel so horrible about what I did. And they don't know what to do with that feeling of guilt. Okay? So then I write back. And in Buddhism, we make a very clear distinction between regret and guilt. Regret is when we're able to look at something with wisdom and realize we made a mistake and admit it, and then make a determination not to do it again, and then get on with our life. Guilt is when we sit there and beat ourselves up about something. I'm so terrible. I'm so awful. How could I have done that? I'm the worst person in the world. Nobody will forgive me. I can't look anybody in the eye again. Na, 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 na. All spinning around. Who's the star of guilt? Who do you think about when you're guilty? Ourselves, isn't it? Me. Yeah. So from a Buddhist viewpoint, guilt is just another form of self-centeredness, self-absorption. Okay. Think about it that way. It's interesting, isn't it? Not only guilt is a form of self-absorption or selfishness, but discouragement is a form of laziness from a Buddhist viewpoint. Think about that. Okay. But discouragement is a form of laziness. Anyway, so I write to them, in Buddhism we have something that's called the four opponent powers, and this is something that we use to purify, because we've all made mistakes, okay? I mean, the basic ground rule is we're no different from the prisoners, okay? We have ignorance, anger, and attachment, so do they. We've made mistakes, so have they. Now, maybe some of them have made bigger mistakes than we have. Maybe we've made bigger mistakes than they have, but we didn't get caught. But basically, all of our minds work in a very similar way. And, you know, we have the same, in Buddhism, Buddha potential, you know, potential to develop impartial love and compassion and wisdom. Everybody has that equally. Everybody has, you know, ignorance, anger, attachment, jealousy, pride, you know, the whole nine yards. We have all of that. Some of us have different mental factors or different emotions stronger than others. But, you know, all we have the same garbage. Okay? My teacher used to say garbage mind. Okay? Same potential, same garbage. Just variations on a variety. You know, variations on a theme, I should say. Okay. So actually, I think acknowledging that is what enables me to relate very honestly to these guys. Because it's not like I'm on the outside and my life's together. But, you know, I'm struggling through this and I work through the same issues as you do. And, you know, we're all in this together and let's learn and help each other. Okay, so I talked to them about the four opponent powers. It takes me a long time to answer a question, okay? Be patient. But, okay, so the first one is regret. You know, being able to regret what we did. Yeah? Not feel guilty, but just be able to regret it. The second one is to be able to repair the relationship in some way. You know, and just dealing with prisoners, I don't talk about, you know, repairing our relationship with Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, or if you're speaking to a Christian, repairing your relationship with God. I don't talk about that so much at the beginning, you know, and until I know more how they are spiritually. But I talk about mentally, in your mind, repairing your relationship with the person you harmed. No, because very often if it's a violent crime, they harm somebody because they were angry and upset. So how are you then able to look at that person without getting angry and upset? Or how could you look at what that person did to you without, you know, flying off the handle? Yeah. How can you cultivate compassion for the person that you once hated or the person that you were angry with? So we talk about that for a while, you know. Restoring the relationship so that we can have a good feeling for the person. The third one is making a determination not to do the act again. No, for some of our negativities, we can't really truthfully say, I'll never do that again. Can you say, I will never gossip again? That's hard, isn't it? We would like to be able to say, I'll never gossip again. But knowing how our mouth is uncontrolled, it's better to say, I won't gossip for the next 2 days and then be really attentive, you know, and then see if we can accomplish that and then extend it day by day, okay? But some kind of determination to avoid it again. And then the fourth opponent power is some kind of remedial behavior, okay? So this could be social service. It could be through spiritual practice. You know, in a Buddhist context, we would bow to the Buddha or make offerings or meditate on love and compassion or recite the names of the Buddha or, you know, do breathing meditation. In a Christian context, you know, you might say your Hail Marys or I'm not really well versed on what all the different traditions say, but, you know, some kind of spiritual practice. You know, Jewish, Muslim, everybody would have their own spiritual practice. But that could be some kind of remedial behavior. And then also just acting kind towards the people that surround you. Okay? So I talked to them about these four opponent powers and how we use them to learn to forgive ourselves and to purify the negative karma, the negative impression that has been set on our mind stream because of what we've done, okay? And so the guys engage in these kinds of practices, and they work very, very well, especially one kind of practice that we do in the Tibetan tradition involves visualization. And we might visualize the Buddha, you know, admit our mistakes, make a request to the Buddha to inspire our mind so that we have courage and internal strength to overcome our own internal weaknesses that make us do harmful actions. And then we imagine that light from the Buddha comes and streams into us, into the interior of our body, filling all of our cells, our entire nervous system, and completely filling us with light so that there's no space at all for unclarity or anger or grasping. Okay? One of my students, and I have some materials, I guess it's on the back table. One of my students is at University of Wisconsin, and he is developing an anger management course based on Buddhist principles, but completely secular. So he took this meditation that we do, and he developed it into one, he calls it the Great Ball of Merit. And so he has the guy visualize, you know, a ball of light that embodies all of the good qualities, and sharing that ball of light and the ball of light radiating light into you and everything like that. So there's many ways to adapt what are usually Buddhist meditations into a secular context. And I've taught Christians these kinds of meditations, but adapted them to the symbology that, you know, is familiar with people in other religious traditions, or people who don't have any religious tradition. So you might take a look at Stephen's work. He's developing a whole manual and a series of, manual for people who want to teach anger management specifically in prisons and jails. So that's on the back table. Also, just why I remember it, there's several different Buddhist newsletters for inmates, and so I have copies of many of them back on the table, so please feel free to take these. And actually, some of the you'll read some of the articles that the inmates have written in them, and that'll give you some idea of how they think and what's important to them. Okay, so that's kind of how, you know, we talk about forgiving ourselves. There was one guy that I write to, and he's in for sleeping with an 11-year-old girl, you know, his brother's stepdaughter. And after we had been writing some time, he had told me what he was in for. And at one point he wrote and he said, "Please help me. I feel so awful about what I've done, and I don't understand why I did it. You know, I really need to understand why I did this. I don't understand." So we wrote back and forth about that for a while, you know, to try and get some clarity on that. And in the process of doing that, and I do this with a lot of the guys, and I do it with myself too, being able to look at the person that we were who made the mistake from the vantage point of who we are now. And, I mean, do it in your own life. Think of it of some huge mistake that you made or some horrible thing you did to somebody else. Okay? And that person who did it is not the same person as you are right now. You know, that was a different person. There's a continuity between that person and who you are now, but they're not the exact same person. But we understand that person well, don't we? If we really spend some time and look at the person that we were who did that really mean thing to somebody else, we can understand that person, you know, how tied up, mentally tight they were, how emotionally hurt they were. You know, we can look back on the person that we were with some understanding of what their situation was, what their conditioning was, how they saw the world, even though it was an erroneous way of seeing the world. And we can have compassion for the person that we were who did that, because we understand that person. You know, and at the same time, we recognize that that person is not who I am right now. Okay, so a lot of the guys, you know, I teach them what I do in my own practice, this kind of thing of being able to look at ourselves with some compassion and understanding and thereby forgive ourselves. Okay, and learn something important from what we did. I jotted down a few other things I should talk about. I should probably tell stories, huh? People like stories. Okay, so let me just go through some random points. One is like at the beginning to establish very clear roles. So I let the guys know I am there to as a spiritual source for you. And of course, spiritual and emotional, I mean, it's kind of who we are and all this comes together. I'm just not talking about God and theology. I'm talking about how our mind works. So it all works together. But, you know, somehow I've never had much request for people to do other things, you know, like get involved in their legal thing or contact their family or send them money or buy them stuff. But because I just send out a very clear message at the beginning that this is going to be the way we relate, you know, I'm here as a spiritual resource. If somebody writes and says, please send me something, I usually say, I'm sorry, you know, I'm here as a spiritual resource and I can't do that. Because you see, some people have the mistaken notion of compassion, you know, and it's like, oh, this poor guy in prison, I'm going to help however I can. Oh, he needs this, I'll send this. Oh, he needs that, I'll do that. Oh, he wants me to do this, I'll do that. And some people can be very manipulative. And it doesn't help them if you let them manipulate you. So that's why I just have very clear roles. And I haven't had a problem, basically, because of that. Okay. One of the things, like I was saying, that how important respect was, because a lot of the fights in prison happen because one guy feels the other guy isn't respecting them. Somebody cuts in front of you in line, they're not respecting you. You know, you have to get angry and, you know, kind of a bit. Otherwise, they're going to think you're weak. And, you know, this, all this kind of rubbish as far as I'm concerned, how people relate. So I talk a lot about what respect means with the guys and how respecting ourselves, respecting somebody else, how you can apologize to somebody and it doesn't mean you're weak, okay? How it takes incredible strength to be able to apologize. So if I accidentally cut in front of somebody else in line, I can turn around with self-confidence and say, excuse me, and get out of line and let that person go first. There's many ways to handle different conflicts and to apologize and to not insist on getting our way without being disrespectful of other people. Okay? And I found that one of the things that speaks the loudest to the guys is just the fact that you treat them like a normal human being who's worthy of respect. And like I said, those of us who have not been in prison, we just take this all for granted. But I remember one time when I was in Madison, I went to give a talk. And this was to a group of inmates. They weren't Buddhist. It was one of these open things, you know. And so the guys just came. And I asked, I talked for, I don't know, 10, 15 minutes. And then I asked some questions. Or actually, maybe I didn't ask questions. They just started reacting to what I was saying. And they started discussing as a group. There were maybe 20, 30 guys. And I would kind of facilitate and point, and, you know, and then I just let them discuss. And every once in a while, I would interject a comment or emphasize an important point that one of them made. And this went on and on. They had a great discussion. And when I was leaving, I was walking out with my friend, the same one who did this booklet, you know, that I told you about. And I said, Stephen, you know, that was such an excellent discussion. How come that happened, you know? And he said, it's because you were genuinely interested in what they had to say and you respected them. And, no, you know, in prison, people don't care beans about what the inmates think. Yeah. And for me, you know, I mean, I love talking to people who are different from me. So I was glad to, you know, I don't need to give a talk the whole time. They can talk amongst themselves, and I'll facilitate and listen. And it worked magic, but it was simply because they were being respected as human beings. Yeah, something that the rest of us so much take for granted. And so I see that also in the letter writing, you know, being responsible when I write a letter. Okay, not putting it on the bottom of the pile and there, unimportant people. I can wait to answer it and then just write a few lines. But they're important people, and I respect that. And, you know, talk to them as an important, as a human being. You know, I'm not sitting up here on some cloud with my life together. And so if I'm stressed out, sometimes I'll mention it in a letter. Okay? And it's kind of interesting, I think, for them to think of, you know, oh, here's somebody who can, you know, admit that she's angry or stressed out, but she's not asking me to fix it. And she's not complaining about it, but, you know, can admit that there's some problem. Okay? So a lot of what we do by modeling. And this thing of respect, you know, respecting ourselves, respecting them, it goes and makes a tremendous difference, really. The whole thing about self-esteem. What I found is, you know, when the guys were writing me, they would sometimes say the most incredible things in their letters. So I would ask their permission and then type out these things and then put them on the web. And then we've also started some newsletters. And I was doing this because I thought what they said was so wonderful and I wanted people on the outside to be able to read it. What I've discovered is that the inmates get a whole new sense of self-respect. Because, wow, something I wrote, somebody else wants to read. They think it's worthwhile. You know? And so other people who also work with these inmates have written me and said, you know, they take so much pride in seeing their stuff in print or knowing it goes, it's going on the web. And, you know, again, because I never studied prison work and how to help people, you know, I didn't realize what an incredible thing this was. One guy we have is a wonderful artist. So I asked him to make little cards for people in our Dharma Center, you know, saying, I take refuge in the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, or saying, you know, today as much as possible I won't harm anybody, today as much as possible I'll benefit others, today I will hold on to my altruistic intention to become enlightened for the benefit of all beings. And just write it out, you know, with nice calligraphy and nice colors on a little card. And he, because he's a very good artist, and he did all of this and he made some cards and sent them to the Dharma Center. And, like, he feels really good about himself. Because here he has a talent that other people appreciate. So I found that encouraging the guys to write, now I tell them, you know, write me a story or write me an essay or explain something to me. Tell me what it was like when you lived on the streets. Because, you know, you can go to and read some textbook about all the data about how many people live on the streets, blah, blah, blah. But talk to somebody who's lived on the streets since they were 12. Then you understand what it means. Yeah? So having them tell their stories of what it's like growing up as who they are and what they experienced and sometimes how they deal with situations, you know, conflict situations when they're in prison. Because I think they have a lot of wisdom that other people need to listen to. So that's wound up to be something that encourages self-esteem. And I also give them, how to say, yeah, sometimes I'll ask them to write stories or to draw things. You know, if I need a card to send to somebody, I'll say, please draw this. Or they'll write to me and say, can I copy, you know, can I draw your picture or picture of the Abbey or whatever. One place I went to, this was a very good prison. They let the guys have a garden. Most prisons will not allow them to garden. Because, you know, you can hide all sorts of implements and dope and everything in the garden. So most prison yards are brown and gray. Not a flower, not a bush, not a tree to be seen. Okay? But this prison had a garden, and there was one man who was hired to work the garden with the people and supervise them. And I came in, and they had picked... were you there at Deer Park that time? What kind of flowers was it? The yellow ones. Were they maybe chrysanthemums or something? Some beautiful flower they had picked, and they had made a lei. And I came in to give a talk, and with so much joy. They brought this beautiful lei to me, you know, which I wore. And then I told them that it was so beautiful that I wanted to give it to my teacher. So I was studying with one of my teachers in Madison at the time. So I gave it to my teacher, who then put it on in class, and we took a picture of it and sent it to the inmates, you know. But it was like this moment where they felt that they had something to give, that there was something they could do to make somebody else happy. You know, this is something we so often take for granted, isn't it? That we can do some small thing to make somebody else happy. But, you know, when you're in prison, it's hard. What can you do? You don't have anything to give somebody. You know, sometimes the guys share their postage stamps or their soap, you know. But to really do something that you know will make somebody else happy, you don't always have that opportunity. And it's a joy to be able to give, and they felt that joy. So I think sometimes providing the space for them to be able to tap into their own joy of being able to give. Or like one of the guys, when I came back from my recent trip from Asia, I wrote and I said, you know, I'm really tired from traveling. And he wrote me just this very sweet letter saying, you know, please take care of your health, and, you know, you have to, you know, do things in moderation, and, you know, take care. We want you to live long. And I know it's really selfish, but, you know, please come and visit us on your once-a-year visit this summer, even though I know that you're tired. But it gave him the chance to be kind of motherly, yeah, and to say kind of caring things to somebody else, which probably in prison, you know, how are you going to do that to other people? A lot of the guys don't have contact with their family. Some of them don't have family. Yeah. I mean, it's really sad. A number of them, they just don't have family. That's it. Another thing I do that works is I ask them to give advice to people who were in, or I put it this way, I say, if you were talking to the person who you were, you know, either around the age that they committed their crime or, you know, or whenever their problems started, you know, started getting really manifest, I said, if you could give advice to the person who you were, what kind of advice would you give them? Looking from the vantage point of what you know now. Or I'll say, because I meet people on the outside who have difficulties, I'll write to an inmate who I know has had those difficulties in their life, and I say, what would you say to this person? You know, like there's one young girl who I've spoken to who's 13, you know, her father's kind of had brushes with the law, her father's a drug dealer, her mother, you know, gets stoned, her mother's going through the second divorce, everybody's screaming at each other. I know her because her aunt is, you know, one of my students. And so I wrote to one of, so both of her parents, you know, are on drugs and alcohol. And so I wrote to one of the guys that I've been corresponding with. He's in prison. He's, how old is he? He's in his 50s now, okay? And he's in prison for a murder he committed when he was 19. Okay? So he was drunk at the time. He killed somebody in a park, I think who was a stranger. He told me that he'll never forget the look on the person's face when the other guy realized that he was dying. You know, what that looked like, what another person who's realizing they're dying, what their face looks like. He says, I have to live with that for the rest of my life. But, okay, he's in prison all these years later. Really nice guy, you know, not aggressive. It took him quite a long time for him to tell me about his upbringing, but it turns out, you know, alcoholic father who would, like, arrive on the doorstep, you know, and pass out, or his father would beat his mother or beat the kids. And so I wrote to him and I said, you know, I just met this young girl who has, you know, somewhat similar family problems to what you grew up with. What advice would you give her? you know, to of how to be strong and endure her teenage years in this kind of situation. You know? And it gets him thinking, you know, wow, somebody can learn from my experience. And, you know, it gives him an ability to reflect on what his experience was and how he handled it then and how he can look at it now. There's another guy that I write to who was a drug dealer, and he has a 20-year sentence, of which he's completed 14. And another teenager that comes to our Dharma teachings, he's a really cool kid, but he came and he said, I have a friend in high school. He's a senior in high school. He said, I have a friend who's really heavy into drugs. How do I help my friend? So I wrote to this particular inmate, and I said, what would you tell kids in high school who are, you know, really into drugs? Because he had told me that, you know, he was into drugs all the way through high school, and then that's how he got into dealing, and that's how he got busted. And I said, what would you tell them? He wrote me the most incredible letter, you know. The essence, it was actually, he didn't know it, but it was a teaching about karma and the effect of karma. He called it causes and consequences. And he was saying, be aware that every choice you make, with every choice you make, you are creating your own future. And even what he called the suds, S-U-D, seemingly unimportant decisions. Okay. He said, even the seemingly unimportant decisions can have a very profound effect on your life, and really take care of them. And then he started talking, you know, in this letter that he was writing to the teenagers, he said, every time I look around and I see the barbed wire and I see the razor wire and I miss my family, I realize this is due in part to my decision at age 13 to smoke pot. You know, he said, I have to take responsibility for the choices I made even when I was little, because it was the choices I made that led to other situations and other choices that led to other situations and other choices. And that's why I'm here right now. And this was like an incredible thing for him to be able to do. I mean, first of all, feel that his experience had some value for somebody else, and it had great value for these teenagers. But also, he told me he had spent a number of years in prison being so full of resentment towards his family and towards his friends, because apparently when he got busted, he didn't tell me all the details. So either his friends deserted him, or maybe some of them turned state evidence. I'm not sure what happened, but there was some kind of big betrayal of trust that went on. And he was really holding on to resentment for a long time. And for him to come to the point and say, actually, it's not everybody else's fault that I got busted. I got busted due to my own decisions, which started when I was an ignorant kid, but I was still the one who made the decisions. I have to be responsible.